Next case.
Moore and others versus Fuller trustee and another, L. Stephen Emmer, appellant counsel, Douglas E. Hale, appellate counsel.
You may proceed.
Thank you, and good morning again. In this appeal, I propose to deal primarily at the lectern with assignments 3 and 4 and touch upon an issue with regard to 5, or maybe assignments 1 and 2 for the issues in the briefs. I will, of course, answer any questions you have about any of them. I do that because I recognize that while a victory for me on assignment 1 would be wonderful, it would be complete and final and end all litigation between these folks, it's not the narrowest grounds for decision in this case. And if you choose to do that, you're going to turn to assignments 3 and 4. Assignment 3 deals with the premise that courts can't adjudicate unpleaded claims. In this case, Fuller and Moore filed a motion to enforce the settlement memorandum. We did too, separately. They're on pages 7 and 12 of the appendix.
What would we do if we agree with your argument? What would we strip out? Because the court purportedly did just that, which is to enforce. But then there's the amendment to the final order, and then there's this language in the order about fraud.
You've identified them. The two things that need to be done are the order that was granted, or that it was entered in January, should be vacated, and a simple order in place of that one saying the parties are
so
directed.
So remand for entry of an order.
An order that says the parties are limited to the terms they negotiated. It's enforced. That's what we pleaded in our on page 7 of this, we pleaded in our complaint. The other one, I think, I don't need to go into too much detail with the 7 of you as to rule 1.1, as to what the judge did 35 days after entering final judgment.
Now let's not get there yet.
Okay.
If you prevail on assignment of error 3, is it at that point game over?
I think the game is over at that
point.
And
it's just simply final judgment?
Correct. But again, keep in mind, we pleaded a theory on page 7 of the appendix. We pleaded a complaint asking that the court enforce the settlement agreement. The court has done that, and I'm not asking you to reverse that, of course. What I am concerned about is that in the body of the January order, the court has made findings of fraud against, among others, two honorable members of the Virginia State Bar who have no reason to face something like that. And the court did that without any pleading that placed the question of fraud into issue.
Well, and I'm not, I don't know whether you're going to prevail on number 3 or not. I'm a little bit confused by the conclusion of your brief. You ask for reverse the judgment and enter a final judgment, but then you also seem to ask that we direct the trial court or direct the parties to take various actions, which would seem to be inconsistent with entering final judgment.
I see. I see now what you're saying, that it's effectively a remand rather than a reversal and final judgment. If that's inexactitude of language, that's mine, and that's certainly not the client's. What I'm trying to achieve is this. Obviously, we want to vacate the language that says that anybody on my side of the aisle has committed any fraud. We also want the parties to be required to carry out the settlement agreement. That calls for delivery of a quitclaim deed, because the language of the settlement of the memorandum of settlement unquestionably mentions quitclaim language. It also calls for full and complete releases of all claims. I think I've quoted that verbatim. What the trial judge purported to do in February was to strip a claim out of that and say that's not released, and also to require us to deliver something other than a quitclaim deed. From the experience that I had as a baby lawyer a long time ago in the dungeons of record rooms, I know a quitclaim deed when I see one. And this is the language of a quitclaim deed: all right, title, interest, and claim. Otherwise, there would be a requirement for a special warranty deed, for a general warranty deed, or for English covenants of title, something that contains an assurance you're getting something beyond whatever title I may have.
So, and the consequence, though, is the way the case was pled. In other words, if instead of seeking enforcement of the agreement, it had been for rescission or some analogous form of relief, then all that stuff might come in, right? But because that's not what we sought, and so the release clause goes along with the rest of it.
Correct. And the release clause is unlimited. It just says all rights, all claims, a full and complete release of all claims. The deed that's called for is exactly what it says in the agreement. It says all right, title, interest, and claim in the Edinburgh property. It's on page 15 of the appendix. And in that situation, it's unambiguous, and it should be unambiguous, but the trial judge sought to change it. And it's foreseeable to me that if it's reversed for entry of some kind of order saying, do this, that the judge may very well say, well, I haven't been reversed on whether it's a quitclaim deed. In that sense, I see particularly now the question, the pertinence of your question, Mr. Justice Mims, that what I've asked for is indeed a form of a final relief, but it's the final relief that we pleaded and that we put in the settlement agreement that says a full and final release.
I anticipate, and I think the argument was made by your opposing counsel, that this really wasn't a trial on fraud. This remained a motion to enforce the settlement agreement, but this was relevant evidence as to whether it should be enforced.
It was set for an evidentiary hearing, as you've indicated. We've described it as basically a trial because that's essentially what it was. Witnesses were called, statements were made, exhibits were admitted, and the trial court made a ruling at the end saying what it was going to do with the case. Whether it was a formal trial or whether it was merely a hearing, the result is the same. The parties are asking, ostensibly asking, for the same thing, enforcement of the agreement that they reached and that they signed in November of that year. And yet the appellees in this case are asking you to do something different. They asked the judge to do something different, and he agreed. But the language of this memorandum is part what the parties crafted themselves. It's not something that a court can relieve them of, and it can't amend that to require that there be something less than a full release of all claims, to really require that there be something more than a deed that conveys all right, title, interest, and claim.
So really isn't the issue that no one's really talking about, but it's the elephant in the room, is collateral estoppel or res judicata? Because there was no relief granted on fraud finding. It's arguably dictum, even though it's obviously an order. They asked for compensatory to $1.6 million. They wanted $350 million. They wanted an attorney's fee award, all on the fraud allegation, which ironically was an affirmance of the contract, not a disaffirmance. The judge didn't give me any of that.
Right.
So ordinarily, most judges would say, well, game over, I've done everything I can do, next case. But he went on, as you point out, to make a finding of fraud. I'm just questioning whether or not, I'm not questioning the appeal, I'm questioning whether or not it really matters in the end. Because there was no holding of the court predicated on finding in terms of giving the relief.
I understand.
Collateral estoppel wouldn't ordinarily apply.
I understand that, too. What I will say, the release ultimately would cover that.
Yeah.
The release, if it's executed as required by this, would cover that. I would be remiss if I didn't point out, however, that the finding of fraud, while it may not matter to the judgment, matters a whole lot to two of my clients, because their reputations are badly damaged by this.
Mr. Dimmer, the question I have, it seems like to me, is concerns where we are in the litigation. Because my understanding of this case is that there was a lawsuit concerning two different trusts that had been put into place and which one was proper, et cetera. And 2 weeks before the trial, one of the sides filed a motion for affirmation of a settlement agreement. In assignment of error 3, you say the court erroneously convened a hearing concerning that and allowed unpled allegations of fraud and didn't give your clients the opportunity to meaningfully prepare a defense to that.
Correct.
So if we rule in your favor on that, doesn't that mean that we require the hearing to be held again? We remand it. We can't say, well, we keep part of what the judge did, even though he had a hearing that he should not have had and did not give one of the parties the opportunity to defend themselves in it. Don't we have to basically redo the hearing? And don't we have to put everybody back to where they were before this motion was heard?
That's not my ideal outcome, but I recognize that it's one of the vehicles that's available to this court. You have the ability under Assignment 3 to simply say, well, we're going to let them try a case on an unpleaded theory, but we're going to give them the opportunity to do it properly. It wasn't done properly. The first time fraud was ever mentioned was 14 days before this trial.
Right. Well, we don't know about the unpleaded theory, but the bottom line is if you don't have notice and opportunity to be heard, then the hearing is null and void.
That's right.
And everybody's back at square one. and do what you got to do.
I recognize that. The best segue for that is to look at assignment four now, which was my next statement.
Now, before you make the segue, why would we remand it for a hearing on an unpledged claim?
I agree.
We're not remanding it for the hearing. We're remanding it for the trial concerning the two trust agreements that have not been resolved. If you guys don't have a settlement agreement and it hasn't been confirmed by court and there's a dispute between the two of you all as to whether or not it exists, that's what the trial is about.
I understand what you're saying, and I don't think that's what the remand would be for. And I don't believe, based upon Mr. Justice Kelsey's question, that either party could ask for that. Because both parties pleaded, please enforce this. Nobody pleaded rescission. Nobody pleaded fraud. Nobody asked the court to uncork this settlement agreement. They all asked, please mandate it. And the judge said, very well, I'll do that. He wrote it in handwriting after scratching out a bunch of language that Mr. Cale had drafted in this proposed order.
Again, I apologize, but for the segue, so the underlying dispute in the two actions, everything's been settled.
Right.
So I'm not understanding what you would do to me. The only reason I can see is strip out the fraud finding, because it's based on an unpledged claim.
Right.
Strip out the release finding, because that's based on a finding based on an unpledged claim. And direct the lower court to enter the proper order and be done.
I think that's right. I think that would give me the complete relief that I'm looking for without going any farther, without having further hearings, just entry of an order. I'll mention one brief thing about assignment four, and then I will
Let me go back a little bit on that. Because it seems like to me where this thing was is you had two parties and they were disputing. If the parties agree that there's a settlement agreement, I think that's correct.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that that really was ever resolved by the court, because the motion comes before the court to enforce the agreement. The court, according to you, looks at improper evidence. It doesn't give one party the opportunity to put on their evidence. I don't see how there could be any legitimacy to that at all.
I understand. And I say, as I say, that's not the relief that I'm hoping for, but I understand that's one of the things that you could fashion. Very briefly on assignment four, I would invite the court's attention to page 15. This is the page of the release, page 15 of the appendix. This is the page of the settlement agreement that calls for the terms of the reliefs. And it says in the third bullet point here, the following assets shall be distributed to Robert Ray Moore. And that's including $400,000 in property on Elbow Road and the nub of this, the Edinburgh property. Now, the parties knew that there was a trust, the Francis Moore Trust, because that appears on the previous page in the second bullet point. They identify that, the Francis R. Moore Irrevocable Trust, and says that it shall not be funded. So the trust had nothing to do with the obligations on page 15.
Can I interrupt you again? But why do we have to address the release? I mean, there was a firm's fraud and inducement claim. And if fraud and inducement were to win, then the release and everything else in the document, if you sought to disaffirm it,
right,
rescission,
if they sought that,
would fall, but that's not what they asked for.
Right.
So the peculiarity here is that it doesn't really matter, because if later there is either a rescission or, for that matter, an affirmance claim based on fraud and inducement, the next circuit court will have to decide, one, whether res judicata applies, and two, whether fraud and inducement voids out the waiver provision. Is that something we need to deal with today?
I don't think so. I don't believe so. All right, I will reserve the rest of my time if I may.
Good morning. The police court. My name is Douglas Cale. I represent the appellees in this matter. Let's talk about the elephant in the room here. It was fraud in the inducement. We filed a motion to enforce a settlement agreement. The hearing was conducted on this motion to enforce a settlement agreement. The trial judge didn't do that. He found that he couldn't do that because Mr. Fuller sought to have the judge to order these attorneys, who are trustees of this trust, to deliver property that they had represented in writing to my client, the beneficiary of the trust, of which they're trustees, that property interest they had was worth $1.5 million.
The conceptual problem with that is that you didn't seek a rescission. You were not disaffirming the settlement. You were affirming it, and you're seeking compensatory damages of $1.6 million, which means, okay, give me the worthless equipment. I'll take it. Thank you. That's been important. Now, it's worthless, and you represented to me it was worth $1.6 million or whatever. And I want damage to that That was the claim that was pled, that was not pled, that was adjudicated.
No. We asked to enforce the agreement in the context of written representations delivered by the trustees that their interest in this piece of property was worth $1.6 million. Not that it's a quick claim deed. You have to look at all the evidence all together. This property, according to the financial documents that the trustees delivered to their beneficiary, this piece of property is worth $1.6 million. Not a quick claim.
Compensatory damages. Fraud with a contract is affirmed or disaffirmed. Two remedies you have to elect. You can't elect. You elected affirmance, not disaffirmance.
And the judge found he could not direct them to deliver any interest in the Edinburgh property because he found that their interest was non-existent. It didn't exist. So he said, I can't enforce that language. I won't enforce that language. I would have to rewrite the settlement agreement, and I can't do that. So he found, and that his finding that they had committed fraud and inducement, that was a necessary finding to explain why he would not enforce the settlement agreement provision directing them to convey valuable interest in this piece of property. That was an essential finding, as the courts looked to explain why he couldn't enforce that provision.
Why is it essential? The enforcement is signing for quick claim deed and it's worth nothing, it's worth nothing. You can't use fraud to modify a contract. You use fraud to rescind the contract or affirm it and you get a sack of money and compensatory damages. But there's no modifying provisions based upon fraud.
And the provisions of the settlement agreement, read in the context of the evidence provided and the evidence that came out in court, was not that they were going to provide a quick claim deed. The agreement didn't say we'll give you a quick claim deed. It didn't say that. It said we'll convey our interest in this piece of property contemporaneous with written documentation provided that said, oh, and that interest is a $1.6 million interest. That's not a quick claim deed.
What does that mean, settlement agreement?
The evidence at the trial, at the hearing, was in the context of the settlement agreement, consistent with what this court said in Murayama. You're in a settlement agreement, ask for specific representations, specific warranties, which is exactly what Robert Moore did. He said, I want something from my trustees in writing, telling me exactly what the assets are in this trust as I come into this agreement in mediation to split up these assets. In response to his request for written documentation, the trustees of the trust gave him documentation saying, oh, by the way, as we're working things out, this Edinburgh property is worth $1.6 million. So you can't ignore what was given to him in the context of the agreement, a contemporaneous document, which certainly would not have anyone think it's a quitclaim deed when the trustees say, oh, and by the way, this interest is worth $1.6 million.
Would there have to be an ambiguity? Because what's before the court is to enforce the settlement. And then all this evidence comes in about this Edinburgh property. Would the settlement agreement have to be ambiguous for any of that to come in to explain what was meant by all right, title, interest, and claim in the Edinburgh property?
Well, what they said in their argument at the hearing was that they had some sort of an interest. So what I was saying to the trial judge back at the time was, that property could be had today. They can perform. They could deliver that property by tomorrow afternoon. They could deliver it by tomorrow afternoon.
Because of the interlocking corporate ownership? Yes.
They could have delivered that. But the judge says, no, that involves rewriting the agreement. I can't do it because it turns out they, in fact, don't own it. But I contend, as I told the trial judge, that you can order them to deliver that property consistent with their written representation given to my client during the mediation that the property is worth $1.6 million. They can do that. He wouldn't do that because he found that it would be exceeding his authority because their interest, in fact, according to his finding, did not exist. But to say it's a quitclaim deed, to say that my client bargained for a quitclaim deed or that it was ambiguous, it wasn't ambiguous in the context of everything that the trustees gave the beneficiary. In that context, there's no thought about an ambiguity or a quitclaim deed. I mean, you have seen settlement agreements that get scratched out at the end of a session. You don't end up with a 40-page legal document that you would if you had a 2 or 3 week time to draft definitive documents. It was scratched out, and it said they'll convey their right, title, and interest Same time, they're showing written documentation from the trustee saying, oh, this is a $1.6 million interest. Is anybody going to construe that as being a worthless quitclaim deed? I contend not.
But that's so, why you have fraud claims for affirmance and compensatory damages. It's just you have to plead a fraud case. You can't just go in on a hearing and say, I have a fraud case and I want $1.6 million and $300,000 in damages.
Well, we weren't seeking damages in that action, Your Honor. We were seeking to enforce the agreement. The judge said he could, and the judge said he couldn't award damages. That'd be beyond his authority.
$1.6 million in compensatory damages and $350,000 in damages and an award of attorney's fees. Wouldn't that have been the motion to enforce?
We waived that. If you heard or saw it early in the proceeding, that we waived any claim for damages as early on. I can't quote the page here right now. And what we were seeking was enforce the agreement. That's the primary action sought there. And that's all the judge.
Well, they didn't know that until they showed up at the trial.
I apologize.
They did not know that. The other side did not know that until they showed up. If you plead a fraud claim in a motion, that's not pleading a fraud claim in a pleading. And then you get to trial and you want a fraud finding, but you realize you're not going to get damages, so you waive that.
But the judge found the fraud, like I said, on his own volition. He found that from the evidence and explained, as you commented earlier, whether it was dicta or not, he referenced that as to why he could not enforce the agreement as to this piece of property, because they didn't own it. So he did not say deliberate quitclaim. He said, I can't do anything because they own no interest to it. Because they committed.
Did you cross error or cross appeal on the process failure to grant specific performance to force the actual conveyance of a fully valued piece of property?
That's what should have happened.
The trial court didn't do that. Is it before us today?
That's the totality of what we were seeking.
Is there a cross appeal in this case?
No, sir.
Are there cross errors?
No, sir.
Well, then whatever the trial court did that hurt your client is not before us. If you want to change the result, you can get additional reasons why you're going wrong. You can't change the result. The result was the trial court refused to get specific performance. Okay, well, if you were entitled to it, we would hear it if it were played.
Well, I don't know that the trial court did something to hurt my client. He declined to do anything more than in his findings in his order, and he did note that he didn't have the authority to award damages, and that in order to obtain damages, that my client had to seek damages in a different action.
Why didn't he have the authority to award them?
Because he stated that given the nature of what was before him, a motion to enforce the agreement, he would enforce the agreement to the extent that he could. That was in his ruling that he couldn't go beyond. He said that in the hearing, so he didn't award damages based on fraud. He said he couldn't do that.
And he didn't award specific performance either.
Well, in his cryptic handwritten editing to the typed order, he said the parties want enforcement of this agreement and proceeds to say it is so ordered in a handwritten fashion. So he says it's ordered that the agreement is enforced. But then, of course, he went further and said as to what can be enforced, he directs them to deliver the $400,000 cash, directs them to deliver the Elbow Road property, but says, but that's all I have the authority to do today. I can't order them to deliver property that they don't own, even though they told the beneficiary that they had an interest worth $1.5 million. So the finding of fraud was his way of explaining why he could not enforce it. So he enforced what he could enforce and said, otherwise, in terms of damages, if you suffer damages because they didn't deliver this other property, you can't. You'll have to separately proceed against them in a different action, which is what he said. Now, as to the release language, the judge talked about, once he read what he had done and realized what he had done with his handwritten cryptic rewriting of the order, he went back and said, well, clearly a court in equity can't require a victim of inducement, fraud and inducement, to release all claims against the perpetrators. He said, clearly, I made a mistake, I made a Scrivener's error, and as this court has addressed before, I believe in the Dorn case, Rule 1.1 allows a court to correct an error, a mistake, inadvertent error,
counsel,
at any time.
Counsel, the challenge is implicit in what you just stated. He indicated clearly he had made an error, a substantive error, because a court in equity couldn't do what he had indicated it could do, and then you called it a Scrivener's error. A Scrivener's error is, I had some sort of a technical issue. I hit the wrong key. I meant to put 100,000 and there's an extra zero. Square that for me.
I think this case, this court in the Dorn case, went a little bit further, and the term Scrivener error is thrown out there, but talks about Rule 1.1. And if I'm reading my notes correctly, the court said that Rule 1.1 does not limit a court's statutory authority to correct clerical errors or errors arising from oversight or inadvertent omission at any time. So there's a Scrivener error. The court seems to, I say, expand or clarify what's meant by a Scrivener error. At a clerical error or errors arising from oversight or inadvertent omission at any time. I think that certainly comes within the scope of what the judge said. He looked back and said, well, clearly I made a mistake when I said the agreement is enforced. Of course, he couldn't enforce the agreement as written, but then he also went back and said, well, to the extent that would cause a person who is a victim of fraud to release their rights, well, it's, inadvertent, I made a mistake. Said as clear as could be. Whether that Scrivener error, it certainly comes within the language that this court addressed in Dorn, and he said it's an inadvertent mistake he made. He caught it. As soon as he caught it, he corrected it.
Okay.
Absent further questions, I will rest. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Most of what I would say at this point deals with the quality of the title that was promised in this, and I don't want to replow the same ground. But what I will mention is, as we cited in our brief on page 26, there's a form for a deed of quitclaim. It's provided by, it relates to a statute, 55-75 of the Code of Virginia, that specifies what title is to deliver that. And in the Brenner versus Lawyers title case, this court addressed what's delivered with that. Now, if they had wanted to get some kind of a title beyond that, a special warranty deed, a general warranty deed, English covenants of title, they could have required that in the settlement agreement, but they didn't. They signed on to language that is unmistakably that of a quitclaim deed. Now, I don't know that I have to drive this point home any further, because I think I have you all on board on this one. There really isn't much that the judge can do beyond ask the parties to comply with what they've agreed to do. They made the bed, and now they lie in it. That bed calls for the delivery of all right, title, interest, and claim, not a warranty, and it calls for the extermination of all claims, a release of any and all claims. That's what the court should be able to do, and that's what the court should have done in the past. I ask you here today to rule that the parties should be limited to the terms of that, a full and complete release of all claims, and what amounts to a quitclaim deed. If that requires spelling out in the final opinion what that title is, that's appropriate, because it will end all these proceedings and we'll be back here again in a year and a half. Since you have a question.
I do. You know, in the final order, what the court in essence says is, and this is the one, I guess it was like January 20th, the court says that, you know, the motion has been brought in front of me to enforce the settlement agreement. And he says, each party has asked that the settlement agreement be enforced, and it is so ordered.
Right.
Period. Everything else after that are just findings. They're not rulings, they're findings. And I find this, I find that, I find this. I'm not going to enforce anything. It's not within my authority to do it. The case is dismissed. And it seems like to me everybody is fine with the ruling of the court in dismissing the case, but they don't like the findings that the court made as part of its order.
We sure don't.
Now, can you appeal the findings and not the result of the court, the ruling of the court?
May I have leave to respond?
Yes.
The answer is that we can appeal the final judgment, and that does appear in the final judgment order of the case. I haven't attempted to segregate whether it's a finding or a ruling and so forth, but the court's judgment does include a finding that there was fraud, and we emphatically want to appeal that. We emphatically want that reversed.
And I guess the question I have is, what is the authority for us reversing a finding and not the final ruling of a court?
Standing here, I'm not sure I can give you a citation that says, here's where you've done that in the past. I can research it if you like and have an answer in within 24 hours. But beyond that, I know that this is part of the judgment of the trial court, and there's a part of the judgment that is fatally flawed. And I think that we have a reason for the court to undo that.
I mean, your client's prejudiced by it. I don't think that anybody would contest that. So then the question is, it's in the final order, it's prejudicial to you, and it was extraneous to what both sides had asked the court to do, therefore it has to come out.
That's fair. I thank you.
And I just know, is there any authority for us ever having done that before?
That's again, what I think I can tell you the final judgment rule 801-670 gives you authority over final judgments. I've taken too long. Thank you for your interest in these issues of this case.
Thank you. Call the next case.